that we have association with those who are awake or who are in the process of awakening, to ourselves awaken. Because in some ways, this knowledge is not taught, it's caught. By the association of those who have it, we catch it, actually. And if we go off by ourselves and simply try to read a book, we won't be successful. Just like if you want to enter into medicine and become a doctor, you can go to the store and buy all the books, and you can go off in a corner somewhere and read them all, but it doesn't mean that you're going to become a doctor. You actually have to go through, enter the class and associate with doctors and so on and so forth. Here's the purport. We'll read some of this on page 75. Since the creation of the material world, everyone has been trying to attain a permanent life. But the laws of nature are so cruel that no one has been able to avoid the hand of death. No one wants to die, nor does anyone want to become old or diseased. The law of nature, however, does not allow anyone immunity from old age, disease, or death. Nor has the advancement of material knowledge solved these problems. Material science can discover the nuclear bomb to accelerate the process of death, but it cannot discover anything that can protect man from the cruel hands of death, disease, and old age. So, around 1,000 years ago, the death rate was about 100%. And what is the death rate nowadays? It's about 100%, 102%. With the advancement of science, our death rate is the same as it ever was. Everyone's still dying. And I was thinking today, actually, just as far as the barometer of our peace of mind goes, because especially nowadays in our Western culture, we live in such a consumer-oriented society that we go through this cycle where we're never satisfied, and sort of that's the environment. So we never find any peace also from the technological advancement that we've achieved so far. So why not look into the process of spiritual knowledge? And it's the most essential knowledge for human beings and human society to base their lives on. Next paragraph. From the Puranas, we learn of the activities of Hiranyakashipu, a king who was very much advanced materially. Wanting to conquer cruel death by his material acquisitions and the strength of his nations, he underwent a type of meditation so severe that the inhabitants of all the planetary systems became disturbed by his mystic powers. He forced the creator of the universe, the demigod Brahma, to come down to him. He then asked Brahma for the benediction of becoming Amara, by which one does not die. Brahma said that he could not award the benediction because even he, the material creator who rules all planets, is not Amara. As confirmed in the Bhagavad Gita 8:17, Brahma lives a long time, but that does not mean he is immortal. Hiranya means gold and Kashipu means soft bed. This cunning gentleman, Hiranyakashipu, was interested in these two things, money and women, and he wanted to enjoy them by becoming immortal. He asked from Brahma many benedictions in hopes of indirectly fulfilling his desire to become immortal. Since Brahma told him that he could not grant the gift of immortality, Hiranyakashipu requested that he not be killed by any man, animal, god, or any other living being within the 8,400,000 species. He also asked that he not die on land, in the air, or water, or by any weapon. In this way, Hiranyakashipu foolishly thought these guarantees would save him from death. Ultimately, however, although Brahma granted him all these benedictions, he was killed by the personality of Godhead in the form of Nrisimha, the Lord's half-lion, half-man incarnation, and no weapon was used to kill him, for he was killed by the Lord's nails, nor was he killed on the land, in the air or in the water, for he was killed on the lap of that wonderful living being, Nrisimha, who was beyond his conception. The whole point here is that even Hiranyakashipu, the most powerful of materialists, could not become deathless by his various plans, What then can be accomplished when the tiny Hiranyakashipus of today, whose plans are thwarted from moment to moment? Sri Ishapanishad instructs us not to make one-sided attempts to win the struggle for existence. Everyone is struggling hard for existence, but the laws of material nature are so hard and fast that they do not allow anyone to surpass them. In order to attain a permanent life, one must be prepared to go back to Godhead. The process by which one goes back to Godhead is a different branch of knowledge, and it has to be learned from revealed Vedic scriptures such as Upanishads, Vedanta Sutra, Bhagavad Gita, and Srimad Bhagavatam. To become happy in this life and attain a permanent blissful life after leaving this material body, one must study this sacred literature and obtain transcendental knowledge. The conditioned living being has forgotten his eternal relationship with God and has mistakenly accepted the temporary place of his birth as all in all. The Lord has kindly delivered the above-mentioned scriptures in India and other scriptures in other countries to remind the forgetful human being that his home is not here in this material world. The living being is a spiritual entity, and he can be happy only by returning to his spiritual home. This is an important determination, because if I still have some hope that I can find some permanent place of happiness in this material world, and I endeavor for it, then I'll be frustrated. And it's natural. I notice this when I travel, that in my mind I'm thinking, everywhere I look, I'm looking for some place where I could actually be happy. And I notice other people do it too. Like I just came back from Honolulu. And while I was there, there are these places where they sell what they call timeshares. You've heard of timeshares. And so people come there and they see the weather's a little nicer than where they live, perhaps. Probably. Most likely. Absolutely. Then someone sells them a deal where they can live there part of the year, thinking that, well, if we just live here, then we'll become happy. By Krishna's arrangement, every time I've gone to Honolulu, quite a few times, I always end up suffering there for some reason. And I always see heavenly place, but I always suffer. And so the point is, however, wherever I go, I'm always looking for a place that might be, like a comfortable place. Even driving up and down the coast, I'm always like, oh, maybe this is a nice town. What if I lived here? What if I lived there? But the point is, Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, that from the highest planet in this material world down to the lowest, all are places of misery, where repeated birth and death take place. You can land in any country in this world, and at first, maybe the externals look a little bit different, but the same theme is there: birth, death, old age, and disease. It's within the Bahiranga Shakti, which means the external energy of the Lord. And it's not our home. Lord Jesus Christ told his followers and disciples that don't invest here. Don't put your treasures here. Put them in heaven. Don't try to make a permanent place here. All of the scriptures of the world say the same thing. This is not your home. This is not a place where you can stay permanently. So if I have some optimism, however, that maybe I can stay here, even if it's subtle, maybe there's a way that no one's thought of yet. This is, Srila Prabhupada's pointing out, the greatest of the materialists have tried. They've done everything to try to make a permanent situation in this material world, and it's not successful. So for advancement in spiritual life, it's a very important decision to make, that I'm going to endeavor to go back home, back to my real life, the eternal life of bliss and knowledge, and not try to make a permanent settlement here. Yes.
My observation in the material world is that there are certain places in this world where we tend to work a lot harder for, to make a buck, and losing track of what is important, right? And I've observed that, relatively speaking, some parts of this earth, you don't have to work that hard to make a buck. You could still make do and still have a lot of time and energy left over to focus on activities that you may consider important. So I guess what I'm trying to say is, if you look at it from an absolute point of view, it's correct. You know, there is no place in this material universe where you will find absolute happiness, because there's always repeated birth and death. But in a relative sense, if your intention is to focus on the spiritual aspect of life and spend more time and energy in that, then you should seek out places whereby or opportunities or situations whereby you would be spending less of your time in the material domain and more of the time in the spiritual pursuits.
Your point's well taken. There are places that are more influenced by ignorance, some more by passion, some more by ignorance, goodness. The forest is considered to be the mode of goodness. The cities are the mode of passion. The factories and slaughterhouses are the mode of ignorance. Is that you?
Well, also, I was thinking, too, when you were reading the purport together. So, Bhana Swami is mentioning how...
Soon to be Swami.
That our external environment, relatively speaking, there's differences. That some may be more conducive to not having to work so hard and having more time for spiritual life. And then other places, like if you go to Japan, there's influence there. People work really hard, 6 days a week, even go to school 6 days a week, and work much longer hours. So there's more of a kind of a force there. So that's the external environment, but also wherever we go, we bring our internal environment with us. Right? So there's that famous saying, they've made a bumper sticker out of it. Wherever you go, there you are. And it's so true. So we may go to Hawaii or other places, but we bring our mind with us and we bring our body with us, and if our body gets some stomach virus, and we can spend our time in Honolulu vomiting and having diarrhea.
Yeah.
Or if we have mental problems or addictions, that will be our environment, our internal environment that we're bringing with us to this other external environment.
Very nice point. And we take our karma. I mean, that is our internal environment created by our karma. It's not that... there used to be a saying, Bengal used to be a very prosperous place in India, where a great center of learning and education, people go to find themselves and, set out to make a wealthy life and such. And there was a great influx of people to Bengal. And there was a saying there that when you go to Bengal, you take your fortune with you. So, we do have that. And this is also an important point that Satyadev Prabhu is making, because wherever we are, we can adjust our internal environment and be Krishna conscious. And sometimes there's a quest always to change the external environment in order to as a contingency, before I'll start my spiritual life, first I have to have this. But there is no external circumstance which can check the desire for spiritual life, actually. It's described in the Srimad Bhagavatam that this process is a haituki and a pratihata. It's unmotivated and uninterrupted by any circumstance. So we find that when Prahlad Maharaj was in this condition, was in the situation, he was a 5-year-old boy, and many of the demigods were offering Sanskrit prayers to Lord Nrsimhadev, he wasn't satisfied. But even though Prahlad was just a young boy, he was able to offer satisfactory prayers to satisfy the Lord. And the reason he decided to go ahead with that, he remembered Gajendra, the elephant, who had offered prayers to the Lord previously and satisfied him. So he said, whether you're an elephant and I'm just a young boy, doesn't matter. If you have the desire, then you can be successful. However, I mean, this in this day and age, it seems that even in the places that were previously unaffected, this kind of idea of materialism is spreading, too. I mean, you used to be able to go to some of these countries and areas where you'd feel a little bit less of the influence of the corporate world. And now it's spreading everywhere. You see corporate logos in different countries, and sort of the whole work ethic of that you're talking about in Japan, and that's here in America and stuff, is influencing all over the world. There are fewer farms. People used to be able to farm. Like even in India, it was based on a whole countryside full of people who had small farms. Gandhi wanted to have the country go back to that more. And now there are more factories, people moving out of farms into the cities, working hard. In America, the family farm is all but gone. It's all been consolidated into big agribusiness. So they're gigantic farms owned by corporations, and they do a big production. But people used to, you know, have their own land. They produce some food. They take it to market and so on and so forth. But in many other countries, you know, corporations have gone there and are, you know, the culture is changing all over the world. So it's even harder to find places where you can find a little bit of peace from this corporate environment. Sort of on a mad dash all over the world to get this increased materialistic culture, which is actually not helping us, really, in many ways, as we're hearing from the purport. We're going the opposite direction. We're forgetting about our spiritual culture, and we're becoming more entangled in the complexities of material life and consumerism and things like that. The more time-saving devices we get, seemingly, the less time we have, isn't it? I have more time-saving devices now than I did when I was a kid, but you know, my parents, not both of them had to work, but nowadays usually both parents have to work to maintain a family. And back in the 50s, there was a lot more time families had together for doing things, picnics and things like that. And now, this is actually an index. When they talk about there's a happiness index, and they measure things like how much time families have together to go to picnics and things like that. And it's going down, down, down with the advance of and the complexity of our technology and materialistic society. We're on the Sri Upanishad, and we're just reading through a little bit of the purport on page number 78. And then we're at the top paragraph. From his kingdom, the personality of Godhead sends his bona fide servants to propagate this message by which one can return to Godhead. And sometimes the Lord comes himself to do this work. Since all living beings are his beloved sons, his parts and parcels, God is more sorry than we ourselves to see the sufferings we are constantly undergoing in this material condition. The miseries of this material world serve to indirectly remind us of our incompatibility with dead matter. That's a nice point there. Maybe we can just discuss this for a second. But the miseries of this material world serve to indirectly remind us of our incompatibility with dead matter. So let's have a few comments on that. How is it that the miseries that we get in this lifetime are helpful to us?
Every time there's a setback or a misery, it gets us to think why we are undergoing this suffering. And it should bring us to a platform of asking ourselves why we're going through this and what is alternative. And search out the path that will put us out of these miseries.
Excellent point. Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu taught Rupa Goswami about spiritual life, and the first question Rupa Goswami asked to Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was, "Who am I, and why am I suffering?" And he mentions there's threefold miseries. In Sanskrit, adiatmik, adibhotik, and adidaivik klesha. So adiatmik means there's miseries that come from our own body and mind. The body's a machine, and it breaks down, and it goes through all kinds of changes. And we can be subjected to all kinds of miseries from our body, and our mind, too. The mind can experience suffering just because of hankering for something we can't have or lamenting for something that we had and we lost. These things go on regularly. Hare Krishna. Welcome. And then there's adibhotic miseries, which are from other living entities. There's all kinds of other living entities we live in the world with, and our interaction with them can cause us misery. The mosquito is a good example. Or, all kinds of living entities that we come in contact with regularly. Microbes are living entities, and they can cause us all kinds of problems. Then there's adidaivik miseries, which daivik means like the demigods or the controllers of the material energy. So excessive heat or cold or extreme conditions in this material world cause us miseries too. So the point that Lord Chaitanya makes is that there's never a time when we're living in this material world when we're not affected by one of these three. Can you think of a time when you weren't affected by one of these three? I can't. I mean, it goes from one to the next constantly. And the endeavor to get free from that is futile by making adjustment to material things. We have this idea that if we just have an automobile, then it would solve a lot of our problems. Then, of course, you have to put concrete down on most of the earth so that you can drive around on it. And then, of course, you have to have people who work in factories that build them, and they have to suffer. And then you have to fuel the cars with oil, so you have to have people go get the oil, and then it pollutes the air, and so on. It creates so many different miseries. Whatever way we try to adjust to the material miseries, they'll simply come out on another side. In fact, Prahlad Maharaj says, oftentimes the cure to these, how we try to cure these things ends up being more suffering than the original misery itself. Therefore, in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna recommends Matra Sparshashta Konteya Shitoshna Sukadukada Agama Payino Nityas Tams Titikshashva Bharata. The key word in this verse is Titikshava. And Titikshava means tolerance. It's one of the principal aspects of yoga and of spiritual life in general, is that one must become tolerant. And there are many things that we have to tolerate and to remain steady in our spiritual life. So this is a very important point. And in the Sri Ishapanishad, the other word used is dhira, that a person who is aspiring for advancement in spiritual life must become dhira, which means undisturbed by external things. So how can we achieve this kind of patience, tolerance, and steadiness amidst so many miseries? Satya?
Well, the cause of suffering is avidya, or ignorance of the self. So by discovering ourself, that's the cure for suffering, and that's the way that we become tolerant, because when we see that we're not our mind, and that we're not our body, and we experience the joy of the inner self, then the sufferings of the mind and the body don't disturb us, because we see it's not us. That's really the only solution. So tolerance develops, and steadiness develops just from that inner experience.
What about practicing tolerance? This is a interesting concept, because what happens when you practice tolerance?
You can practice and then blow up.
Or you can practice and see the benefits too. In other words, like when you tolerate certain kinds of things and you find that, for instance, if there's an urge, right? And, you know, you experience an urge, but then you tolerate that urge, then you can actually, if you step back from it, you can see it for what it is. If you give into it, you actually become absorbed in it and you forget what it is. But if you step back from it and tolerate it, you're able to see it for what it is. And it comes and goes. Urges don't stay forever, right? They come and then they go away at some point. What about that?
But that's also part of developing. That's one of the ways that we discover who we are, is by not giving in to the urge and seeing that it passes. And we've been there watching it the whole time. And then we see that we're different than the urge rather than identifying it. So tolerance is a way of developing self-knowledge.
And so on one side, then, we have to have something, a place to go to, other than that urge. If we just tolerate, Satyadev Prabhu brought up this point, we can just blow up. In other words, sometimes we tolerate, and then all of a sudden we just give into it, maybe even more than we did before, because we don't have anywhere else to go. So Krishna consciousness, or the practice of bhakti, is the positive alternative, because if we can develop a taste for the activities of bhakti, specifically starting with shravanam and kirtanam, there are various activities in bhakti, starting with hearing and chanting. And if we develop a taste for those things, then it will be very easy for us to tolerate the other things, because we have some place to take refuge. And we know there's a place where we can actually have inner fulfillment, where we don't have to take help from some external urge. And as a matter of fact, as Krishna describes in the Bhagavad Gita, for one who has experienced this higher taste, the lower taste, or the certain urges which are temporary, they become insignificant to a person who's experiencing higher pleasure from within. And in the scope of our practice, you know, being where we are now and trying to get to the next level, we have to take one step at a time. That means proper practice. So from whatever stage we're at now, if we practice diligently and make a little bit of advancement to the next level through the practice and detachment, then we can make steady progress to the next level, a step-by-step progress. By slow degrees, we can make advancement. So Krishna recommends in the Bhagavad Gita that although the material world is overwhelming and the things that come to us, the desires that come to us are overwhelming, if we practice a little detachment, it will be very helpful for us. He calls it this asanga shastrena. The shastra means a weapon. There's two things. There's shastra with a long A, which means the scripture. And there's shastra, which means a weapon like a sword. So asanga, which means to step back from material desires a little bit, to see what they are, have some place to detach ourselves. Shastrena, that becomes a weapon by which we can detach ourselves from this entanglement in what Krishna calls the material tree, the tree of material life. He describes it as a gigantic banyan tree where you can't tell what's up and down. It's so large that you can't see where its beginning is, where it started. And we see, even through science, we try to study, even if we go to the genome and we study far down into the cycle of genes and everything and try to figure out, well, where'd we come from? You can't see the end of it. Even Brahma, who is the first created being, when he was born on a lotus flower, he looked out and he saw darkness. And then he tried by his own power to figure out where he was and who he was, but he couldn't. Then he heard the words tapa, two syllables, one word, tapa, which means perform this devotional activity, this austerity, this detachment. So he practiced that, and he got special help from Krishna from within the heart. Externally, Saraswati, goddess of learning, appeared before him and gave him a mantra, this practice of chanting God's names. And then by practicing that diligently, he had some place to go other than the darkness. He could go within himself into this mantra. So Chaitanya Mahaprabhu has come and distributed this process in this dark age when things are very complicated and it's hard to figure out, you know, what's true spiritual life. Everyone's claiming, you know, only this way, only that way. And then there's people say there is no way. Just, you know, live hard and enjoy yourself and die. It doesn't matter. So Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was given a simple universal process, and that's by chanting God's names. If you chant God's names, then immediately you have connection. You can feel it immediately. It's not that you have to wait for some you know, distant time or revelation. We have an eternal connection with God, and through his name, we can actually be connected with him immediately and experience for ourselves what our spiritual nature is. This is the power of what Chaitanya Mahaprabhu gave us. He said, Nam Nam Akari Bahuda Nija Sarva Shaktis Tatrarpita Niyamaitas Manane Nakala. That God's name has all of his personal shaktis. It's the same as he is. There's no difference whatsoever. And therefore, he recommended that the main means for advancing in spiritual life was this Samkirtan. Samkirtan means chanting God's names congregationally, as a group. This the power of this group prayer of God's name. Then this is Samyak Kirtan. It's the complete glorification of God. Then by that, everything comes. Means Cheto Darpana Marjanam. The heart, which is the seat of the soul, becomes purified and illuminated by chanting God's name. Cheto Darpana Marjanam Bhava Maha Davagni Nirvapanam. We're living in a samsara, which means we flow from one thing to the next, which is birth to death, birth goes into death, birth goes into death, over and over again. And it's compared in the Vedas to be like a burning forest fire. We're being burned by that fire. And when you have a gigantic forest fire, what you need is rain. Even airplanes flying over can't help it. Even fire departments trying to do back burns and everything like that can't help it when it's too big. You need rain to come. You need the weather to change. So this chanting, it makes a weather change in our life. It changes everything. It actually opens for us so that mercy of God can come down to us. Bhava Maha Davagni Nirvapanam. It extinguishes that fire by God's rain of mercy on us through his names. Cheto Darpana Marjanam Bhava Maha Davagni Nirvapanam Shreya Kairava Chandrika means that good fortune comes into our life. Everyone's searching everywhere for good fortune, and it's available. But it comes through this chanting process. All good fortune comes to someone who experiences this chanting for him or herself. Shaira kai rava chandrikavitaranam vidya vidhu jivanam. Knowledge becomes a concomitant factor for one who chants and hears. Knowledge, which is defined by Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita, what is actual knowledge, Rakshit Prabhu? What is the definition of knowledge?
Well, it is to know that we are not this body, but we are in the 13th chapter, Krishna says that we are not the body, but we are really the knower of the body. And that is equated with the soul that is situated in the heart of a person. So the knower knows his body. And in addition to this, there is a super knower who knows all the bodies. That's the Lord. But the main message is knowledge is to know that the body is just a field. And in this field, there is a knower, which is the living entity, who knows one's body. The living entity has to distinguish himself from the body. He's higher than that.
Thank you very much. So that can be achieved. Thank you. That can be achieved when one performs Sankirtan. One can actually see, I'm not the body. I'm living inside the body. The body's a machine, complex machine, and I'm only here. This is my field of activity for a very limited amount of time. We come through this life very quickly. And according to Shastra, scripture, this is a very important field that we're in now. We've been in many, many fields, according to Shastra. Bahunam Janmanam Ante. We can go through many, many different lifetimes, over and over again through this cycle. However, when we come to the human form of life, it's called Nrideham, that this Nrideham is very special because it's like a boat that can carry us across the material ocean. And there's favorable things that will help us. On a boat, you need wind, you need a sail, you need a captain. So the captain is like the spiritual teachers, spiritual master. The winds come from the Shastra. Mayanukulin and Abhasvateritam, Krishna says. The teachings of the Bhagavad Gita, when Krishna gives those instructions, it's like the wind that will carry you across. So remember, every time you're reading Bhagavad Gita, you're putting wind in your sail to take you across the material life. Then you need
a sail.
So this body is the boat. The human body is the boat. Then you have the captain, the spiritual master, and you have favorable winds, which are the Shastra, that take you across. Nride hamadyam sulabam sudur labam lavam sukalpam gunukarna dharam. Mayan kulin and abhasvateritam puman baba dimna teretsa atmaha. So,
page 279.
If you want to look it up, good idea, in this book, page 279.
What's the sail?
The sail's part of the boat. Top of page 279. The human body, which can award all benefit in life, is automatically obtained by the laws of nature, although it is very rare achievement. This human body can be compared to a perfectly constructed boat, having the spiritual master as a captain, the instructions of the personality of God as favorable winds impelling it on its course. Considering all these advantages, a human being who does not utilize his human life to cross the ocean of material existence must be considered the killer of his own soul. So, very favorable field that we have now, and to take in the help of Krishna in the form of the Shastra and the spiritual teacher, then we could easily cross beyond the material life.
I found a verse that Rakshaprabhu was referring to in the Bhagavad Gita.
Oh, thank you. Which page?
Yeah, it's on page in the Bhagavad Gita. Well, actually, it's nice to read the questions too. Which page 564? Does Arjuna ask Krishna to define knowledge? So he said, Arjuna said, "My dear Krishna, I wish to know about Prakriti nature, Purusha the enjoyer, and the field, and the knower of the field, and of knowledge, and of the object of knowledge." And Krishna answers, "The Supreme Personality of Godhead said, this body, the son of Kunti, is called the field, and one who knows this body is called the knower of the field." And then text 3, "O sign of Bharata, you should understand that I am also the knower in all bodies, and to understand this body and its knower is called knowledge." So that's the definition of knowledge for Krishna, is someone who understands that they're the knower and not the body. That's actual knowledge. And later on he goes, "Anything else except this is ignorance." Later on.
Thanks, Sadhu Dev. Okay, so let's go to the Bhagavad Gita now, where we already delved in. And we're on chapter 3. Karma Yoga. So far, in our discussion of Karma Yoga, does anyone have anything that stood out in your mind from the verses or the discussion that we've had so far on Karma Yoga, Chapter 3? Anything at all, even if it's a small point, or something you remember from one of the classes or a verse. Let's do it as a view. I remember something. I remember Sati gave a class last week. Was it last week?
Yes.
And you talked about the verse, yad-yad acharati shreshtas. That verse was about how whatever a great man does, whatever a great person does, other people follow. And therefore, Krishna was emphasizing that it's important if you're a leader, if you're a spiritual leader, that you should follow carefully so that others will do the right thing, because people will follow what you do. This is one thing that I remember from we had discussed that verse. What other discussion have we had on Chapter 3?
I remember in the early part of the chapter, Krishna's talking about how the living entity gets entangled in this world in their karmas. And he says the living entity, you know, because we have this body, we have to work. We cannot stop our activities. We cannot just shut down our senses. Especially the common man cannot just go off in the jungle and live on air, you know, and then just absorb himself within. So Krishna says the solution to this is that if you perform all of your sacrifices, if whatever you do it as a sacrifice for Vishnu, which he calls yajna, I think this is like in the 8th or 9th verse, then one who engages all his activities as a sacrifice for Vishnu, he transcends the influences of the material nature. So you become free. You can become free from your karma by using all of your mind and your senses in the service of the Lord. Basically.
I remember something that came up last week also was a discussion about how we were talking about demigods, and was Srinivas was here, and he had read the verse that, you know, the demigods are supplying us so many things, so we have to offer them something in return. And so we had some discussion about the fact that we're getting so many benefits in this world, and we may assume that they're free, but actually they're not. Human life is a life of responsibility, and that responsibility means that we have to give back. And as Krishna says, there's a cycle, there's a wheel of sacrifice, that we're being given things, all kinds of facilities in this world, and that through sacrifice we should give back to those who are giving them to us, namely the demigods. Of course, I think one of the points that we were touching on was that the enjoyer of all sacrifice ultimately is Vishnu. There are millions and millions of demigods, and it's not that you can individually go to each demigod and try to offer them some sacrifice. And therefore, in the 9th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna calls this process avidhi, which means not proper or not according to regulation. He recommends that because he's the source of all the demigods, that you offer sacrifice to him, and then the demigods automatically become satisfied, just as when you water the root of a tree, all the leaves and branches become satisfied automatically. So do you remember we had that discussion last week? That was something we talked about.
That's on the
show. Yeah.
What kind of a sacrifice? I'm not getting the real meaning of that. As in,
what is sacrifice?
Yeah, mean? What kind of sacrifice?
That's a good everything. Question, because that could mean anything, right? Sacrifice means that everything that we do can be connected to Krishna. So there's a very famous verse in the ninth chapter of the Bhagavad Gita in which Krishna says, Yat Paroshi Yat Ashnasi Yat Johasi Dadasi Yat Yat Tapasyasi Konteya Tat Kurushva Madarpanam. And that means that whatever you do, whatever you eat, whatever you offer or give away, should be done, Krishna says, as an offering to me. And that way, he says, you'll become free from the reactions to material life. There are material nature has there are actions and reactions, and there are certain debts that we incur by living in this world naturally. And karma is a very entangling web. We become entangled in karma by living in this world. There are living entities that we kill, for instance. When you cook food, you can't help but kill. Even if you're a vegetarian, you kill living entities when you eat food. It's just natural. Like when you light a fire, the Vedas say. When you light a fire to cook food, even if you're a vegetarian, there are living entities in the air that are going to be killed. When you're going to pick out the food and then you wash off the vegetables, there's all kinds of... I know I garden. And when I go pick my own vegetables, there's living entities everywhere that I have to, you know, like... Okay, we're keeping this one, you can't have it. Everything you do with your life incurs some kind of reaction. You can't help it. But, Krishna says, if you do all of your activities in a God-centered way, you remember Krishna when you do them, and you offer them, like for instance, when you eat, there's a simple thing is everyone has to eat, right? So instead of just eating anything, first of all, should have a simple diet and offer the things you eat first to God. Patram pushpam palam toyam yome bhaktya priyashati taraham bhakti paritam ashnami pariyatapanah. Whatever you, if you offer with love and devotion, Krishna says, a little leaf, a fruit, water, I'll accept it if it's offered with bhakti, with devotion. So this is a simple thing. Eating food, we should offer our food first to God with some, you know, with some devotion. Like it, you have an apple, instead of just like, thanks, you know, or even not thanks, just take it and eat. But if you offer it first to God and recognize this was created by someone, this is given to me, it's valuable, thank you. And you offer it back to God as a, you know, as a sacrifice first. Then you eat. This is the meaning of sacrifice. So everything can be done like that. There's not one thing that can't be connected to Krishna. Therefore, Krishna says, whatever you do, whatever you eat, whatever you offer or give away, connect it to me. Give it to me. Somehow connect it to me. And then you live a purified life. This is called sacrifice. And Krishna says, Bhoktaram Jamitabhasam. This means that Krishna... He's the one we can offer things to. He can accept them unlimitedly. He can take things. And this is our nature. Our nature is that we're givers. That the more we give of ourselves to others, the more satisfied we become, actually. But some people, they can only accept so much. Like, let's see, as an example, Gandhi. Gandhi was a giver. He wanted to give to so many people. And he gave to his countrymen so much, isn't it? I mean, and eventually he gave his whole life, because even though he gave so much to his country, at the end there was a certain group of people who weren't satisfied and they killed him. He was assassinated. And it's happened all over the world, even in our John F. Kennedy. You know, he was trying to serve his country. He said, ask not what the country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. And he was assassinated by somebody. You know, so in the material realm, we can only give so much because people can't accept that much. Some people like some, but Krishna can accept everything. Even in the Srimad Bhagavatam, described how Putana, who's a demoness, and she intended to kill Krishna. When she came to Krishna to kill him, she smeared her breast with poison when he was a baby and wanted to feed him her breast milk and kill him with her poison. But Krishna just accepted, well, at least she's offering breast milk and she's like my mother, so even though she's trying to kill me, I'll accept that part, that she's my mother. And she was liberated. So Krishna's the supreme taker. He can take everything from everyone and absorb it, and the giver gets benefit. So not everyone can do that.
We can't do that. Our position is the givers, and we become happy like that. So the more we give to Krishna, the more satisfied we become, and it's unlimited. We can go on giving unlimitedly, and Krishna can go on taking unlimitedly and enjoying it. And then the more he enjoys, the more we simultaneously enjoy. And Prahlad Maharaj just said, Pratibhukasya. He said it's just like the person who looks in the mirror and then puts on some decoration on the face. You know, you look in the mirror and then you decorate your face. The reflection's also decorated. So we're connected to Krishna as his part and parcel. So when we decorate Krishna, when we give to Krishna, we become decorated. We become whole. We become satisfied. This is yoga. How to connect to Krishna. This is the great science. If I try to take more and more and more, I won't become satisfied. I'll simply become exhausted. I can't take that much. I can't eat that much. I can only digest a few japatis. But Krishna can digest millions of japatis. So we can go on offering to Krishna and we'll feel satisfied. So sacrifice, yes, please.
Those are, you gave some real practical examples of sacrifice, like offering food. But I was also thinking there's a verse where Krishna said, love sacrifices. You sacrifice time and you sacrifice your awareness, right? To sit down and chant the holy names with concentration. We have so much limited time during the day, so many things that are pressing us to do this or that, maybe other things we want to do. But we take that time and we sacrifice it to Krishna by chanting the holy name. That's it. And he says of all the sacrifices, I'm Japa. That's a practical example of sacrifice.
Thank you. Nice point. Have you chanted Japa? Do you chant Japa? You have beads? Do you have beads? I just noticed, because right when you brought that up, our the curator of our gift shop, Mataji, just walked in with our portable gift shop. And so we have beads available for anybody who wants to chant Japa. If we just continuing on this idea of sacrifice, let's look on page 223. This is in the fourth chapter. Starting on page on text 25, on page 223 of the Gita, Krishna's naming all kinds of ways people do sacrifice. He says, some yogis perfectly worship the demigods by offering different sacrifices to them, and some of them offer sacrifices in the fire of the Supreme Brahman. Text 26. Some, the unadulterated brahmacharis, sacrifice the hearing process and the senses in the fire of mental control. And others, the regulated householders, sacrifice the objects of the senses in the fire of the senses. So he's giving an analogy here because if we go back to text 24 on page 222, Krishna says, a person who is fully absorbed in Krishna consciousness is sure to attain the spiritual kingdom because of his full contribution to spiritual activities, in which the consummation is absolute and that which is offered is of the same spiritual nature. So the Sanskrit for this verse, Brahmarpanam Brahmahavir Brahmagna Brahmano Hutam, Brahmaiva Tena Gantavya Brahmakarma Samadhida. It gives this example of someone who's offering a traditional fire yajna. When you sit down for a traditional homa, and the fire is lit, it's considered to be the representative of Vishnu. The tongue of Vishnu is there as Agni. And then you're offering oblations of ghee into the fire. Everyone's been to a fire sacrifice here. They offer, in India, it's very popular, Vedic culture, and swaha. You make actually say, I'm offering this into the tongue of Vishnu when you're offering into the fire. So now, in these other examples that Krishna's giving, as you go forward in these verses, he's showing how each one of these activities, whatever situation you're in, whether you're a brahmachari, a celibate student, or a householder, you have family responsibilities, there are ways to offer into that fire. And so he's giving all these examples as if, you know, it's a fire yajna, and whatever you're doing, you're offering something into that fire. So he continues.
Does it mean that anything good or bad you do, you can sacrifice?
Yeah, the question was, does it mean that anything good or bad that you do, you can sacrifice? No, it doesn't mean that. In the Bhagavad Gita, Srila Prabhupada explains, it's not that we can offer whimsical things to Krishna. The intent is also important. There's a character in Bengali lore, and his name's Gopala Ban, and he's an example of a great rascal. So one of the things Gopala Ban, his friends were criticizing, how come you never offer anything to God? And Gopal Bansi said, that's not true. I offer things to him all the time. And he's carrying a big tray of grains on his head. And a big gust of wind comes and blows the grains off his tray. And he goes, see, I offer that to God. Because it was gone anyway, right? So Krishna's no fool. He knows what we're keeping back, and he knows what we're actually offering. And therefore, he said, patram pushpam palam toyam yome bhaktya prayachati. The best kind of offering, the best kind of sacrifice is in bhakti. It's in love. Like if someone offers you something and they don't really care, like if someone comes over to clean your house but they don't really want to be there and they just do it anyway and they kind of do a sloppy job, you know, maybe they're on a prison release work program and they have to do it or something. I mean, how much do you appreciate it? But if someone comes over because it's your birthday or something and they say, listen, I want to clean your house. I love you. You know, you're such a great person. You've done so much for me. And they go through your house and they do a nice job. It's a difference, isn't it? So it's not mechanical, actually. It has to do with our state of consciousness. Everything's about consciousness. And it's personal, too. We're offering to a person. We're offering to God. He's a person. And so he'll accept this offering when it's given in love. And in fact, if it's given in love, even if you do it wrong, he'll still accept it. There's a story in the Mahabharata when Lord Krishna was trying to intervene and stop this war, the Kurukshetra war. He went to negotiate with the two sides. And when he went into the city, there was Duryodhan. And he had prepared this gigantic feast. He was very rich. He was the king. And he made a huge feast with all these different preparations. And he invited Krishna to come there. And Krishna didn't want it because Duryodhan didn't have any devotion for Krishna. It was all political. On the other hand, he went to his devotee's house, to Vidura's house. And Vidura lived in a very simple place. And his wife was home. And she became so excited that Krishna was there, she started offering him bananas. Only she was so preoccupied the fact that Krishna had walked into her house, then instead of offering the banana, she offered him the peel. And when Vidura came home, he saw that Krishna was sitting there eating the banana peel because it was offered with love by a devotee. So he'll accept things when they're offered, you know, with the right intention. And Srila Prabhupada even mentioned that if we're offering some sacrifice out of devotion and we're doing it because we're really trying to please Krishna, but even if, for instance, you know, we can't pronounce the mantras correctly. Prabhupada said, Krishna doesn't consider that. He considers the fact that you tried to offer it and that, you know, the intention was there. Does that answer your question? So intention is very important. Even in the law, of course, we've said this, made this example many times, but in the law, when you kill somebody accidentally, it's not considered as severe as if you planned it out, you had a little map, you knew where they lived, you went on Google and found out about duct tape and all this kind of stuff, and then you hunted them down and killed them. You're going to probably have special circumstances, they call it. You know, you might even get the death penalty because your intention was so strong. What is it?
Premeditated.
Yeah. So intention, it makes a difference in every realm, what to speak of when we're dealing with Krishna. So if the intention is there, Krishna will consider. So continuing in these verses, 27, on page 226. Others who are interested in achieving self-realization through control of the mind and senses offer the functions of all the senses and the life breath as oblations into the fire of the controlled mind. So in the Patanjali yoga system, there's ways of controlling the breathing so that you can fix your mind on one point. Having accepted strict vows, some become enlightened by sacrificing their possessions, and others by performing severe austerities, by practicing the yoga of eightfold mysticism, or by studying the Vedas to advance in transcendental knowledge. Still others, who are inclined to the process of breath restraint to remain in trance, practice by offering the movement of the outgoing breath into the incoming and the incoming breath into the outgoing, and thus at last remain in trance. Do you do this, Satya? Stopping all breathing. Others, curtailing the eating process, offer the outgoing breath into itself as a sacrifice. All these performers who know the meaning of sacrifice become cleansed of sinful reactions, and having tasted the nectar of the results of sacrifices, they advance towards the supreme, eternal atmosphere. Purport on page 230. From the foregoing explanation of different types of sacrifice, namely sacrifice of one's possessions, study of the Vedas or philosophical doctrines and performance of the yoga system, it is found that the common aim of all is to control the senses. Sense gratification is the root cause of material existence. Therefore, unless and until one is situated on a platform apart from sense gratification, there is no chance of being elevated to the eternal platform of full knowledge, full bliss, and full life. This platform is the eternal atmosphere, or Brahman atmosphere. All the above-mentioned sacrifices help one to become cleansed of the sinful reactions of material existence. By this advancement in life, not only does one become happy and opulent in this life, but also at the end, he enters into the eternal kingdom of God, either merging into the impersonal Brahman or associating with the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Krishna. And the next verse is very definitive. Krishna says in one line, Nayam lokos tijagnyasya kuto nya kurutsatama. It's a question. He says, O best of the Kuru dynasty, without sacrifice, one can never live happily on this planet or in this life. What then of the next? So, sacrifice is a way of life, actually. And in when one realizes that, everyone's making a sacrifice. In fact, Srila Prabhupada points this out in the Srimad Bhagavatam, in the famous verse, Nayam deho deha bhajram nriloke, kashtam karmam arhate vidbhujamye, tapo divyam putraka yena sattvam. He says, there's a certain kind of sacrifice or tapasya that's called divyam. It's divine. It's transcendental. But that doesn't mean that if you're not performing that you're not performing sacrifice. Everyone performs some sacrifice. It just means you're probably performing some kind of what's called ugra karma, or very horrible kind of work that you're suffering anyway. I mean, everyone has to work hard or perform some kind of sacrifice in this life. And probably gives the example, he had probably just been in Japan when he wrote that in the fifth canto of the Bhagavatam, but he was talking about how he saw people going to work 4 to 5 hours one way on a train just to work at a place, and then 4 or 5 hours coming home and working long hours, as Satyadev Prabhu was pointing out, 6 days a week. Some people work, we see in Japan. And on the seventh day, when they have a day off, they're also, I heard from some devotees there, they're expected to be in the office anyway, even if they're not doing anything, just to show their loyalty. That's not sacrifice? Yes, it is. But it's, what are you getting? Who are you pleasing? So Rupa Goswami says, Kama adinam katida katina palita durnideshas. He says, for how long and how many ways have I served so many other bad masters who have never given me time off, who have never given me any mercy, who has never given me any spiritual awakening, but I go on serving them anyway. So he says, now my intelligence is awakening, and now I realize that the kind of sacrifice I want is towards Krishna, towards God, because that's very sweet. We say, when you take one step towards Krishna, he takes 1,000 steps towards you. He's the greatest benefactor of the truthful devotee. Someone who just has that truthful intention of moving towards him by one step, Krishna will make all arrangements to help that person. So that's the best kind of sacrifice, because God helps those who help themselves. So that's recommended in Bhagavad Gita throughout, that one take to this simple method of just worshiping Krishna. In fact, in many of these chapters, Krishna describes many different processes of spiritual life and of sacrifice, but you'll find that at the conclusion, he always gives the idea that simple process of devotion to him is the easiest method. For instance, in the 8th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, he talks about all the different ways that you can leave this world in the dark, in the light, and at certain astrological signs, the yogis are all trying to manipulate the material energy so they can leave at the right time to attain liberation. But Krishna says, the bhaktas don't care for this. The bhaktas just leave whenever they leave because they know Krishna is there to protect them. And that whatever time they leave their body, Krishna will make up for it. Vedeshu, yagyeshu, tapasu chaiva, daneshu yet punya palam pratishtam, atyeti tat sarva vanam vaditva, yogi param stanam upaiti chajam. That the bhakta is not bereft of what is attained through all other methods of yoga, he says in that chapter. All the other ways of offering sacrifice are made up for if one is offering in bhakti. Therefore, bhakti is the process, the most direct process, the Bhagavat Marg, the direct process of worshiping Krishna, the safest path. So, in chapter 3, we're talking about karma yoga. And this means that we're offering sacrifice through our work, because you have to work. Krishna has said in this chapter, chapter 3, Nahi kashchit shanamapi jatu tishchat karma krit. Karyate hyavasha karma sarva prakriti jayar gunai. You can't stop working even for a moment. Even if you close your eyes and sit down in a quiet place, what will happen? You go to the most serene place in the world and sit down and close your eyes, and what will happen? Will everything stop? What is your answer? What will happen? Let's analyze it. What will happen? Because this is important to see the different aspects of work. Say we go to a quiet place. Take the week off. And you go to a quiet place, a waterfall or someplace, there's a pool of water. And it's just a grassy little cove. No one to bother you. And you sit down in that grassy little cove. You want to try it? You close your eyes and see. Imagine a grassy little cove. And then there's your little pool of water. Maybe there's a half cave there. No sounds from jets, anything. Are you there? Okay, close your eyes. Go there, that place. Now you're sitting there. Now concentrate between your two eyebrows. Fix your mind right between your two eyebrows, sitting in that place. Now keep your concentration there. And observe where your mind is going. What is it thinking? Who can say now? Do you have any experience of, did you see your mind? What were you thinking? Where were you going? Jamuna? Where did your mind go?
My mind?
Yeah. Like, what were you thinking when you closed your eyes? Like I was thinking, yes. You were going to say, go ahead. Did you have a thought?
Where am I?
Okay.
I was thinking 10 things I have written at work. I think you have something.
And Srivas was thinking about what he had to do at work. His mind went back to his work in the office, right? Some things you haven't completed. Anyone else? Rakshit?
It's just difficult to concentrate in between the eyebrows, the tip of your nose. It's like you require exertion to do that.
Okay. So it was difficult? So felt some difficulty? Anyone else have any experience? Yes, Luann.
So the water, the cave, uh-huh. And some trees and
Nice. Good. Anyone else? Yes, Jonathan. Is hungry. Okay.
What am I
going to
eat next?
Nice. So all these things, where's my work? I'm hungry. Where am I? Luann was actually visualizing, seeing the place there. It doesn't mean because you close your eyes and you sit in that place that you become inactive. In fact, the more we practice this, sit in one place, try to see, you know, where your mind's going, you'll find it goes all over the universe. It's taking us everywhere. And this is the nature of the mind, that even if you go to sleep, will your mind be inactive then? No, you dream. You'll see, you observe someone else dreaming, their eyes are moving back and forth when they get this REM sleep. Because their mind's active, and in their subtle body, their gross body's lying there on the bed, right? But they're active. So Krishna says, Nahi kashyat shanamapi, jatu tishyat karmakrit. You're always active. So this karma yoga means there's always activity for us. So how are we going to channel that activity as a sacrifice? How do you make it a sacrifice for Vishnu?
Think of him in his pastimes.
Okay, you can think of him. That's one way Krishna says it. Can you back that up as a verse from the Bhagavad Gita? Well, there's a couple of verses right away that you can get. Manmana bhavamad bhakto. Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, both in the 9th chapter, the very last verse, and in the 18th chapter, he says the same thing, two places. Manmana bhavamad bhakto. He says, engage your mind in thinking of me. So Bhanu Prabhu has proposed that one way to be active is to engage the mind in thinking of Krishna. So, yes? Page 245 in the Shloka book. Okay, page 245. Oh, nice. This is something I wasn't expecting. Okay. So this is an example of Maharaj Ambarish, given in the Srimad Bhagavatam. He engaged everything all the time. He was a great king, so he had a lot of responsibilities, right? And so he was able to engage everything in Krishna's service. Savai mana Krishna padara vindayor vachamsi vaikunta gunarnuvarnane. Karau herar mandira marjanadishu shutim chakarcha chuta satkatodaye. Maharaj Ambarish always engaged his mind in meditating upon the lotus feet of Krishna, his words in describing the glories of the Lord, his hands in cleansing the Lord's temple, and his ears in hearing the words spoken by Krishna or about Krishna. And the next verse says that he engaged his eyes in seeing the deity of Krishna, Krishna's temples and Krishna's places like Mathura and Vrindavan. He engaged his sense of touch in touching the bodies of the Lord's devotees. He engaged his sense of smell in smelling the fragrance of Tulsi offered to the Lord, and engaged his tongue in tasting the Lord's prasad. So all the senses have a way to be engaged in Krishna's service. And the mind is the center of all the senses. As Krishna says in the 15th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, what does he say? He says that the living entities are eternal parts and parcels. Jiva loke, jiva bhutasana, manakshastan indriyani, prakritistani karshati. He says that we're all parts and parcels of Krishna, and that we're struggling very hard with the six senses, including the mind, which is the center of the different senses. So when the mind's controlled, then the other senses can come into control also. So this is a very practical thing to think of Krishna and to meditate on Krishna. And as recommended in the Shastra, the easiest way to think about Krishna is to hear about Krishna. Because it works like this. Shravanam Kirtanam Vishnu Smaranam. Smaranam means to remember. And your mind becomes naturally engaged in thinking of Krishna if you hear about him. And if you hear about something on CNN, it's natural that you'll think about something that happened on CNN or happened somewhere else in the world, right? I mean, something happened today in Darfur, wherever that is. And if you hear about it, then your mind will think of that. But if you hear about Krishna, your mind will naturally think of Krishna. So what other ways? Engaging one's activities in Krishna's service. Karma yoga. Practical things. Yat koroshi yat ashnasi, yat johosi didasi yat. This verse means whatever you do, whatever you offer, whatever you give away should be done as a sacrifice for me, Krishna says. And so what are some practical examples of that in daily life that we can relate to? Okay. You said it simultaneously. Jonathan's saying prashad, and you're saying we have to eat, so?
Daddy.
Yes?
So we have to eat, so whatever we need, if we offer to Krishna and eat them as a, and that, you know, we cook for Krishna, we offer it, and then we take his remnant, so that becomes sacrifice.
Okay, and is that a very difficult thing to do? No? Yes, Luann. Yes.
You mentioned, for me, when you say you sacrifice, the food is still there, you eat it. Like one person is down, and Krishna is here, and you say that you sacrifice for Krishna, but you don't give to the hungry.
Mm-hmm.
Then what? Is that sacrificing to Krishna or not?
Is giving to a hungry person sacrificing for Krishna?
No. If you don't give to the hungry person,
uh-huh,
but you say that I think of Krishna, I sacrifice to Krishna, but then I don't give the food to the hungry,
mm-hmm,
then...
Yes?
If I understood your question right, is philanthropy not equal to Krishna consciousness? Is that what you're saying? I'm sorry.
So there is a way in which we can sacrifice by giving in charity to others. This is also recommended by Krishna in the 12th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. Let's look at this. Thank you for your point, Luann. Look in the 12th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. And Krishna recommends different ways of being engaged in yoga or connection with him. So we start with text 8, which is on page 550. He starts with, just fix your mind upon me, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and engage all your intelligence in me. Thus you will live in me always without a doubt. Text 9. My dear Arjuna, winner of wealth, if you cannot fix your mind upon me without deviation, then follow the regulative principles of bhakti yoga. In this way, develop a desire to attain me. 10. If you cannot practice the regulations of bhakti yoga, then just try to work for me, because by working for me, you will come to the perfect stage. Text 11. If, however, you are unable to work in this consciousness of me, then try to act, giving up all results of your work, and try to be self-situated. So, in the purport, Prabhupada says, it may be that one is unable even to sympathize with the activities of Krishna consciousness because of social, familial, or religious considerations, or because of some other impediments. If one attaches himself directly to the activities of Krishna consciousness, there may be objections from family members or so many other difficulties. But for one who has such a problem, it is advised that he sacrifice the accumulated result of his activities to some good cause. Such procedures are described in the Vedic rules. There are many descriptions of sacrifices and special functions of punya, or special work in which the result of one's previous action may be applied. Thus one may gradually become elevated to the state of knowledge. It is also found that when one who is not even interested in the activities of Krishna consciousness gives charity to some hospital or to some other social institution, he gives up the hard-earned results of his activities. That is also recommended here, because by the practice of giving up the fruits of one's activities, one is sure to purify his mind gradually, and in that purified stage of mind, one becomes able to understand Krishna consciousness. Of course, Krishna consciousness is not dependent on any other experience, because Krishna consciousness itself can purify one's mind. But if there are impediments to accepting Krishna consciousness, one may try to give up the results of his actions. In that respect, social service, community service, national service, service for one's country, etc., may be accepted so that someday one may come to the stage of pure devotional service to the Supreme Lord. In Bhagavad Gita 18:46, we find it stated, Yata pravritir bhutanam. If one decides to sacrifice for the Supreme Cause, even if he does not know that the Supreme Cause is Krishna, he will come gradually to understand that Krishna is the Supreme Cause by the sacrificial method. So there are some people who do philanthropy, who feed people, for instance, you know, like a food bank, or, you know, do massive welfare work for people in general, but maybe who don't believe in God or don't have any connection with God at all. And there may be a case also where I'm feeding people, but then I may be killing animals, as an example. This is given as an example that I'm trying to do good for one kind of living entity, but then I'm discriminating and I'm killing another living entity. So there's a discrepancy there. And also, when one does philanthropy, for instance, if I do good for humanity, it doesn't necessarily mean that I'm serving God directly. There's a way in which I'm becoming benefited, because it's the nature of the soul to give. And when we give, we become more in this spirit of giving. And that brings us gradually to this point of giving everything to God. And when we give to Krishna directly, it's like watering the root of a tree. We become the benefactors of all kinds of people. Now, the highest kind of charity is to give people knowledge. Because as Lord Jesus Christ pointed out, you can give a man a fish, or you can teach him to fish. So if you just give him a fish, he'll be hungry the next day. There are elephants in the forest that eat millions of tons over their lifetime, or thousands of tons anyway, of food over their lifetime. And according to, you know, the law of karma, we've been in many different species of life. We might have been an elephant in our last life and eaten so many things. So just by feeding people alone, it doesn't necessarily equate into doing direct service to God. But if we do it in connection with God consciousness, then it has great benefit also. Because when we give people, for instance, prasadam, or food that's sanctified and it's first offered to God, then when someone takes that, the Bhagavad Gita says, they're eating food that's been sanctified by sacrifice, by an offering. So the idea is that God's the center, and by offering to the center, then others become satisfied also. And the example is given like the stomach. If you feed the stomach, then it automatically feeds the hands and the legs and the ears and the eyes and everything. So if I try to feed the hand independently, then it'll wither and die because it won't become satisfied. So also, if we try to save the dress of a drowning person, it doesn't necessarily mean that we saved him. This is not a case against feeding people, which is one of our missions, actually. We're a kitchen religion. We like to give out food as much as possible. In fact, Srila Prabhupada, when he was in Juhu Beach in Bombay, when he first started the temple there, there were all kinds of children coming regularly to the temple to see Prabhupada and to take prasadam, because it used to be a fishing village in Juhu, and it just started developing right around the time Prabhupada bought the temple there, which was around 1970s early. And all these kids were coming. And when Prabhupada saw all the children, the villagers in that area, he wanted the devotees to set up stocks of food so that all of them, everyone within the radius of the temple, would be fed. It's natural for a devotee when they see suffering or they see someone that's in some condition to want to reach out and help them. However, a devotee doesn't make the mistake of thinking that just by doing that, that they're, that is going to be satisfactory, because there are lots of food programs and medicine programs all around the world, and it's a means that if I save the body, it doesn't necessarily mean I've done that much work. As an example, if someone's drowning and I jump in and I jump in to save them and I get back out with their coat and say, look, I got him, everyone will say, you're crazy. You just brought the coat back and the person's still drowning. So similarly, if we save the body but we don't help their actual eternal progress, then there hasn't been that much progress. So those are a couple ideas. And anybody want to add? Yes. Yeah.
Thank you very much for coming.
Oh, thank
Hare Krishna.
And secondly, is about the philanthropy program you're talking about in the temple. I mean, we have in ISKCON, we have a program called the Food for Life. The institution as such has a program specifically targeted for feeding the poor people or anybody, I mean, who needs food. It's called the Food for Life. It's not. It's very much active in other. I mean, in other larger temples. So, I mean, they go by trucks and go to the place where they're gonna. I mean, where poor people live and they distribute food. But that's. What, I mean, there's. It's not very much active here, but in other parts, in other temples where they have more budget, they do it.
Yeah, I just came from Honolulu, and they have a gigantic kitchen there, and trucks going out all day long, taking food to people all over the islands. Actually, it's one of their main programs. Devotees are up early cooking. So it's this distribution of food should go on. Luann, this is her first time here.
Welcome.
You've already did you already talk before you came?
No, I saw her invite. I mean, I saw that she RSVP'd, so I was expecting her.
Oh, nice.
Nice.
Nice
to see you.
We have a place on meetup.com that Prashant has started, and there are many, many people interested in hearing Bhagavad Gita all over this area. And Luann has come from that. Thank you very much.
She said that
it's
not far away from
San Diego.
Meetup,
did
you come from meetup.com?
Yes,
meetup.com. Nice.
Yeah. Yes, I am pretty new in the area. And I look for friends and I want a place, a group of people with I feel safe.
Well, please be our friend. We want you to be our friend. We want to be your friend. Okay. Yes, Rakshit.
An afterthought that there was also the implication. The way I understood the question was that I see a hungry man and I'm going to feed Krishna. Am I doing him some service? Which was a question that went through my mind. And when you mentioned that we offer food to Krishna, we feed Krishna, in practical terms, what we are offering to Krishna is then used as prasadam to feed the living entities. So we see a hungry man, and here we are offering food to Krishna. We will ultimately distribute it to him if he is in our surroundings. That means we will give it as prasadam to the person.
Prasadam.
Prasadam is the food that is offered to Krishna are the remnants that are given to the living entities or those who worship him. So whatever gets offered to Krishna, then the remnants are used by people like us as prasadam or food. So by ultimately by offering to Krishna it, it's going to serve the living entities.
Thank you. Yes, Luen.
I may be a little weird here.
We encourage that. We like weirdness.
Let's see. If I have a bowl of noodles, and this is a man who is hungry, and I also need to eat, and I would say that I offer my bowl to Krishna, I'm thinking of you, you are the Lord of the Lords of everything. You are everything. But in reality, I don't feed the hungry. I save that food for me. I say I sacrifice to Krishna, but actually I sacrifice for me because that bowl of noodle I eat, I don't save, I don't give to the poor here. Krishna,
I see your point.
Eat the real okay. bowl of food. I'm the one who eats it.
Yeah. Okay, yeah.
So
I see your point now. Now, the a person who is advanced in spiritual life is called paradukha dukhi, which means that he or she suffers to see the suffering of others. And in our tradition of spiritual teachers, there's a great example named King Runtidev. Runtidev lived many thousands of years ago, and he's an example for all of us how Vaishnavas think and act in that circumstance that you're talking about. And Runtidev had fasted, as sometimes in some practices devotees will fast just for some time. And he had fasted, we don't do this, but don't be alarmed. He had fasted for 1 year, I think, or maybe longer. And then he was about to break his fast. So someone brought him a plate of food, and he was just about to eat, and somebody came who was hungry, and so he gave him half. And then he was just about to eat again, and of course you can imagine after fasting for so long how hungry he might be. Then another person came who was also hungry, and he gave him that half of what he had. And he was about to eat again, and then it was a dog came or something like that. What was it?
Chandala.
A chandala? Okay. Anyway, more and more people came, and then finally a dog came even. One person after another, others who were hungry came, and he successively gave away everything that he had. Then those different people who had come revealed that they were actually divine beings who had come to test him and to see, you know, what was his real nature. So the nature of a spiritually advanced person, is what we're talking about, is that he or she can't tolerate to see others in the environment who are suffering. So it's not that someone would just, it's not proper etiquette, someone just offers something to Krishna, and then if someone is hungry or suffering, then like, just, well, I already offered to Krishna, so I'll just eat it, and that person can go to hell or starve to death. That's not the nature of the devotees. The nature is to show compassion, to show kindness to others. There's a way in which that, you know, Satyadev Prabhu was a paramedic for 20 years, worked for the city of San Francisco. He's right here. This is Satya. And the first thing that they taught him in paramedic school is that a dead paramedic can't save anybody. And that means that when you're going out to save people, you better make sure that you're safe yourself before you go in to save them. So it's also not the case that, you know, we will just throw caution to the wind and not be fortified ourselves, because even this is natural even in philanthropy. When people go to other countries nowadays, you know, Doctors Without Borders and things like that, they take all caution and make sure that they're in sanitary conditions and that they're eating themselves. They have their own food supply because they have to be alive to take care of other people. And no matter how many other people you take care of, you know, people are going to die. It's natural. It's just, I asked Satyadev how many people he saved. How many people did you save, Satya? And people who look like they're going to live, die, and people who look like they're going to die, live all the time. I mean, much of this thing is up to in Krishna's hands. So who can we actually save also? You know, but the point is, my point of that story is that devotees should show full compassion to all living beings at all times. And it's not that devotees don't hoard. They make available as a mercy offering to as many people as possible. In fact, that's our mission here. Our mission here is to gather together and then cultivate this knowledge ourselves and give it out to as many other people as possible in the form of knowledge, books, in the form of food that people can eat. And it's special food. It's food that is sanctified. So when they eat it, they actually get spiritual benefit. This is part of the philosophy that Rakshit Prabhu was saying. Prasadam, or food which we first offer to Krishna, is special. It has a spiritual nature. And many people who have come here, like Kishore, can attest to that, you know, they came because the prasadam, or the food, was so unusual, was so nice, that they became attracted, that there's something special about it. And it's cooked with love and devotion, and it's offered to God. And so it's very special. So when you give it out to other people, they become benefited spiritually as well. So it's like it's a sacrifice in and of itself. So that's very much part of the culture, is to offer to Krishna, then to give to everybody. Does that make sense?
Yes. I mean, I made a conclusion that I offer to Krishna by the mind,
mm-hmm.
by the devotion and the emotion and spiritually,
mm-hmm.
but I don't actually offer the materials. The materials still here for me to eat or to share with others.
Yeah, that's right.
So it's just offering or sacrifice by the mind, not by the giving the whole.
Yeah, well, Krishna's so kind.
Seems
yeah.
So easy, though.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well,
I can say it, but. Well, I can give here to the hungry, and then on the other hand, I think I'm lost.
Well, when we offer to Krishna, we prepare an offer to Krishna. Krishna is not material, he's spiritual.
Right.
So,
and when we offer to him, we don't offer materials.
That's right, exactly. What Krishna is eating is our love. He's accepting our love. He takes the bhakti. And when he looks at Krishna can eat with his eyes, he can eat with his ears. And when we offer a sincere prayer to Krishna, please accept this apple. I offer it out of love. Then Krishna can accept that from us through the very intention that we're offering it with, through our mind, to offer to Krishna.
So then when we give
mm-hmm.
or sacrifice to human beings, living, we give materials.
Mm-hmm.
Am I correct? I
mean, well, because we have a material body, right. And we have to eat grains and fruits and things like that just to survive, right? So practically, yes. But it's a very subtle thing. But when you offer something to Krishna first, which may appear material, like a grain or a fruit or milk or something like that, and you offer it with love and devotion, then it takes on a spiritual nature. It transforms. Just like if you take an iron rod and you put it into fire, if you leave it in fire long enough, that iron rod, although it's iron, it becomes fire-like. It's non-different than fire, actually. And it glows just like fire. And if you touch it, it will burn. So anything that's used in Krishna's service, because Krishna's so powerful and he's all spiritual, when that material thing is used in his service, it takes on a spiritual quality. It transforms. Because it's all Krishna's energy anyway. It all comes from Krishna. It's not separate from him. And just like this, you can take electricity, right? And you can run it through a heater, and it comes out as hot air. Or you can run it through an air conditioner, it comes out as cold air. It's the same electricity, but it comes out in different ways. So Krishna can transform energy, material to spiritual, spiritual to material. And it's based on our consciousness. That's how it gets transformed. Actually, everything's ultimately spiritual because it all comes from Krishna. But if we misuse it, or we use it for our own enjoyment rather than offering it to Krishna or seeing it in relationship to Krishna, it takes on a material quality. So to transform everything back to its original spiritual quality, we offer it to Krishna. We engage it in his service. Then it becomes spiritualized. And that kind of the vibration that it takes on is beneficial to everybody. Even if, what to speak of human beings who eat, if other lower living entities eat that kind of food or come in contact with the vibration, they hear the chanting, the prayers, or they eat the food, then they also become benefited, Shastra says. They get a spiritual benefit even without knowing it. It's called agyata sukriti, or spiritual credit even without knowing it. So we all have a bank account in our heart. And every time we get contact with this spiritual energy, we get a deposit. And when it gets filled up enough, you can make a huge down payment. So this idea, when we give out spiritual food, means that, yes, we're offering to Krishna the food, although it's a material thing, apple, grain, it becomes transformed. It takes a different nature, a different vibration than when you give it out, which that's what we do. We give it out to everyone without discrimination, actually. Every person we can meet, we'll give it to. That they get, yes, they taste it and they go, thank you, now I feel better. But they also get spiritual benefit. And, it's not something, it's something actually that you can talk to many people who have come and experienced this, you know, all over the world from every different culture who have had tasted prasadam, or food that is offered first to God. It has a different vibration. The soul is very subtle and can feel these things. It's like if you meet someone who has a hate in their heart or something like that, and you have a contact with them, they may say sweet things to you, but you can feel they don't like me. You know, so the soul subtle can feel these things. So the soul is more subtle than the mind. It's more subtle than the intelligence, and it can pick up these spiritual things. So when food, when speech, when activity, when it's connected with Krishna, they become very beneficial to the soul. And that's the whole idea of this mission, is to spread that kind of vibration through the written word, through the food, through the work, you know, how to connect work and make it more subtle, more spiritual. That's the idea. And that's the idea of this chapter, Karma Yoga, how all work, all thought, everything can be connected to the spiritual plane, to Krishna. And then it becomes joy-giving. It becomes happiness personified. I mean, we can feed people and give out dead chickens, poor chickens. They're kept in cages, you know, their whole life, and then they kill them. And yes, okay, I fed someone, but what did I do to their soul? I may have given them more karma, you know. It's now, was it a benefit that I actually did to them, right? Okay, I fed them, right? But now they have some karma that goes on life after life because they ate some thing that was killed. So we have to consider both sides. That's the idea. Hare Krishna.